CataractCoach.com. Welcome to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, episode number 14, with a young, important surgeon, Dr. Nandini Venkateshwaran. She is in Boston at the Mass Eye Institute at Harvard Medical School, and she is a true leader in our field, an incredible speaker, educator, and surgeon. And you're seeing more and more of her on the podium because she really brings a special insight and expertise and allows us to learn these complicated new techniques and technologies. You have a fantastic time listening to this podcast. I enjoyed it so much. She really is a breath of fresh air, and I look forward to learning from her on the podium for many years to come. She is truly one to watch as a future key opinion leader in our field. Check it out. So I want to welcome you guys to our Cataract Coach podcast, and this time we have Dr. Nandini Venkateshwaran, and she is a cataract corneal refractive surgeon affiliated with Harvard Medical School and the Mass Eye and Ear in Boston and at a satellite office in Waltham. Nandini has an amazing background. She's done superb training, residency at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, then a cornea fellowship at Duke, and she was even in the combined straight-through combined undergrad plus med school at University of Rochester, so she's cranked through those years. We're exactly 20 years difference in our training. I finished my training in 2000. Nandini finished in 2020. So 20 years difference. And what I'm really impressed about with her is how she's had a meteoric rise in the key opinion leader world of ophthalmology. And I also love that you have an incredible passion to always keep up with learning the newest procedures. So welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
The main thing that I want to get out of this is that I want to explain to the young ophthalmologists who watch this podcast or listen to it that they can certainly be just like you. They can be cutting edge with all kinds of surgical procedures for a pretty wide spectrum, whereas I just do cataracts all day. It's a refractive. You do cataract, refractive, cornea, complex anterior segment, like a big spectrum. And the other thing is how to really get your name out there, to be on the podium. It's amazing to see someone like you so young already on the podium. So kind of what was your path? After you did residency and you did your fellowship, then what?
You know, I just want to start off by saying thank you so much for having me. I remember when I was a med student applying for residency and even a resident and fellow, I would listen to podcasts of people that I looked up to, and I would love to hear what their paths were to get places. And it was so inspirational, especially if it was like a young woman surgeon. I was like, what do they do? How are they getting where they are? And it's cool to be on the other side to hopefully inspire the next generation of ophthalmologists. So thank you.
You're doing it already. You're doing an amazing job.
You really reach such an amazing audience. And my trainees will say how much they watch Cataract Coach and learn. So it's pretty awesome. So thank you.
So, oh, of course, our pleasure to have you here. But really, you've made quite an impact at a very young age. You're probably early 30s. You've done far more at that age than I did at that age. I feel like I'm lazy in comparison.
Oh, gosh, not at all.
But how'd you do it? Like, you finish your fellowship, and then how do you just get on the stage?
Well, I think a lot of it came from kind of the networking and the mentorship that I had. I mean, definitely my mentors have played a humongous role in where I am today. Folks at Bascom-Palmer, folks at Duke really kind of identified me as someone who had potential. And they are people I continue to reach out to when I have questions or if I'm interested in something. And I'm always someone who vocalizes interest. So I'll say, hey, I have a really big interest in getting more involved with ASCRS. You know, is there a way to do that? Or I really like working with, say, this company. Is there someone you could introduce me to so that I can start talking to them? And I think having people to turn to make those introductions has been really invaluable. You know, say at my fellowship at Duke, Terry Kim was one of my attending. So he was such a wonderful connection to ASCRS. And I was able to start to work with the ASCRS Young Eye Surgeon Committee. And that has been a really fantastic way to run symposia, to run wet labs, to be on the podium, to speak. And a lot of the people I actually started working with in industry, I met as a resident. These were my reps who met me, like my Alcon rep. He knew me so well because I wanted to try the Restore Multifocal. I wanted to get trained on Aura. I wanted to do femtosecond laser surgery. I reached out to a lot of his colleagues, and many of them stayed in touch and introduced me to folks when I became an attending. Similar to a company, Dompe, I met one of the key MSLs in the company when I was a resident at ARVO.
Medical Science Liaison.
medical science liaison. And then now she's connecting with me to help me give disease state awareness talks about, you know, neurotrophic keratitis and get involved in clinical studies and, you know, speak to other physicians about the medication. So a lot of it has been really organic. I think I just like connecting with people, and I also have a really genuine passion in the different things that I see and do. And that has been a really nice way for me to get involved and get my name out there.
So I even made a mistake. I thought you were doing this after fellowship. You actually started really early. Even as a resident, you wanted to be involved.
But unintentionally. Like, I think I always was like, it's so cool to get involved with industry. They're always on the cutting edge. I want to learn about the new things coming out there. And I learn a lot from them, just like they learn from me. Like, they'll ask me questions, and I'm like, I'm just a resident. Like, why are you asking me? But then as you start to move on in your career, you wear these different hats. They're quizzing you. They're like, how would you market this? How do you implement this in your practice? What are the pros and cons of how this works? And you start to think about things in different lights, and that relationship grows with time. And I mean, I'm sure you've seen this too. You've known a lot of these folks in industry, like, since you started, and now many of them work in different companies, but you interface with them in so many different ways. And I think that's part of the fun of ophthalmology. You're friends with your colleagues, with your industry partners, with everyone that you interface with.
Yeah, it's like a big family. You're absolutely right. But you were always precocious, though. I did some homework. You actually finished your bachelor's degree early, and you worked with Ken Rosenthal before starting med school even.
So
Ken's obviously a fantastic ophthalmologist, very complicated cases. He actually was one of the first people in the U.S. to do those the aniridia trials, putting in the artificial irises. Mm-hmm. Neat stuff to work with him. So another great mentor. And then you also credit Dr. Hinman when you were in medical school.
Yes. You know, my introduction to ophthalmology was so fortuitous. I graduated college early, and Dr. Rosenthal is my family ophthalmologist. He did my grandma's cataract surgery. She had like one of the first lenses? Yeah. They were the multifocal lenses. She was like in the trial, had a free lens, and like would sit around with no glasses. But Dr. Rosenthal was like, hey, I'll hire you. You're smart. You know, I need a tech. Let's see what we can do. And it became this very wonderful experience of where I became a technician, a surgical coordinator, and a research coordinator. So I was working up patients. I was counseling them on premium cataract surgery packages as like a pre-med student.
That's so cool.
And then, you know, actually enrolling patients for the Human Optics Artificial Iris, you know, compassionate use device exemption, and eventually FDA study. I mean,
so I saw your name on that paper. Yeah. That was when you were just still basically an undergrad.
Yeah, right before medical school.
Wow.
But it was just, I loved it. I did not expect it. I was like, wow, this area is so interesting. It's this fusion of surgery. There's so much pathology. You get amazing relationship opportunities with your patients. I became so close to so many of the patients that I got to know as his tech. And then when I started residency, those skills were just very easily translatable. For me, it was easy to talk to patients because I would go home and practice and be like, how do I talk about astigmatism correction and the crystal lens and the accommodating lenses that he was putting in at that time, and trying to show patients the value of premium lens implants. So it was just, I laugh at it because I'm like, I was very fortunate and I was blessed in that way, because I don't think many people have that unique opportunity. And it was just this really wonderful way for me to get an introduction.
We have a lot of residents who listen to our podcast and obviously watch Cataract Coach videos as they're learning surgery. What pearls do you have for them to get involved at a young age? Because I did almost nothing. I did nothing as a resident. And very few of the current key opinion leaders that I know of, at least not my generation, we didn't do anything as residents other than residency. But you obviously did a whole lot more. What's the first step? Ask your faculty members for advice or to connect you with people?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think first off, hopefully wherever you're training, you have an ophthalmology department. So when I went to the University of Rochester, I immediately identified the medical student educator that was part of the ophthalmology department. So that was Dr. Holly Heinman. And I expressed to her like, hey, I used to work as a tech. I'm really interested in ophthalmology. How can I get involved? So I would take time out of my schedule to shadow her in the clinic. I would go to the operating room. I immediately asked for opportunities to write case reports or any small projects. She even had me make a case report into a grand rounds presentation. So I was the first year medical student presenting at ophthalmology grand rounds, which was terrifying, but such a learning experience. It was about a unique case of epithelial ingrowth post cataract surgery, injecting 5-fluorouracil into the cyst, treatment options. Wow. And then you just get these opportunities of presenting clinical cases, sure, thinking through differential diagnoses. And then I actually worked a lot with the residents at my training department. So
while you were a med student.
Yeah, I would say, hey, I'm a med student. Like, I'm really interested. Can I spend time in the resident clinic with you? So they would allow me to work up some patients in their resident clinic. I would practice refracting. I spent like an hour trying to see the fundus with my 90 diopter.
I think we've all been there.
They were like, did you see that? I'm like, yeah, of course. I should be able to, right? I'm supposed to be an ophthalmologist. But, you know, I would take those opportunities, and they were very generous with their time. And we had free clinics at our medical school. We had an ophthalmology free clinic. So these were underinsured patients that would come seeking eye care. And so faculty would volunteer their time. You can spend an hour per patient really talking about their history, diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, how to refract, stuff like that. So I think all of those small steps will add up.
Sure.
And long-term relationships with mentors are so critical in residency applications today. Like, I always tell, you know, residents here, you want letters that are valuable. You want someone to have amazing anecdotes about you that really show your work ethic, your surgical prowess, your ability to think as a diagnostician. And if you can have someone who's worked with you for 4 years or 3 years, that speaks volumes to who you are and what your capabilities are. So that's what I would encourage folks to do.
Make connections, basically.
Make connections. And it doesn't have to be the chair of the department. It can be, you know, one or two faculty members that have stuff going on that are enthusiastic about working with students. And I think that can organically grow into more connections. They can introduce you to people. They can give you projects to present at meetings. Now we have all these meetings that med students go to. I didn't go to any meetings at a medical student, but, you know, Young MD Connect is becoming a really amazing platform for young ophthalmologists. I went this year, and I would say a lot of the attendees were med students, which
was
so
cool. Wow,
that
young. Yeah. For an ophthalmology meeting, wow, that's so interesting.
And so I think that's growing, and the online community is growing too, where, you know, you're able to connect. You can have virtual mentor sessions with faculty members. Those opportunities weren't as big when I was in medical school, but those are things I think trainees should seize. Because any FaceTime you can get is really important. And I think you'll be surprised how many people will remember you, even from a small interaction or if it was a meaningful conversation.
Yeah, and you said something else earlier, that the people you work with on the industry side, they don't leave ophthalmology. They may go from company A to company B to company C over the last 20 years, but they're still in ophthalmology. So it's interesting. I don't know any of these industry people who go from ophthalmology and say, you know, time to switch to cardiology or orthopedics.
I know. Usually they've come from cardiology or ortho, and they were like, I found ophthalmology. This is my haven.
It's such a gold. Yeah, it's a really golden little field here. So you finish your training. You then start as faculty. How did you decide to do private practice versus academics versus some other job or a hybrid? Or how do you navigate that space? You have great training under your belt. You're an amazing surgeon, amazing public speaker, amazing researcher. But now what?
I know, it's tough. I think I chose a fellowship at an academic center because I wasn't really sure which way I'd go. And a lot of the advice I'd been given is, if you're interested in staying in academics, it's nice to go to a fellowship that's in academia versus private practice. I don't know if that's true, but that's something to think about for, you know, trainees out there. And then in speaking and seeing a lot of my mentors, you know, many of them had thrived in academics, and academics is what a lot of us know, right? This is where we're born and bred. There is a nurturing kind of collegial collaborative environment. There's so many people around you. Trainees keep you young. So for me, I was kind of looking in academics mostly, but private practice was in the back of my head, of my mind. But the opportunity at Mass Eye and Ear was unique because it was really a full-time position at a satellite practice. So it has kind of a hybrid nature to it, where the satellite functions on its own. It's largely a cataract refractive anterior segment-based satellite, but I still have all the connections to the main campus. I'm operating there. I'm working with residents and fellows. I'm in the emergency room. So I kind of have the best of both worlds, which was a really nice fusion for me. And I still have opportunities to engage with my faculty members in clinical trials. I've initiated some industry-sponsored research myself. So it allows me to keep my fingers in different pools and different areas of interest and also have that pathology I wanted. I think tertiary care centers see some of the toughest cases, and I enjoy those cases. And I don't want to necessarily lose that skill set yet. I'm not ready to hone in. I love doing a little bit of everything. And so that patient population is very accessible at a place like Mass Eye and Ear. And I mean, it's pretty cool. I met Klaus Dohlman. I went to his 100th birthday. I went to his 100th birthday party. I think I was the youngest attendee, but
that's so neat.
But it's so inspiring. Like, you see that he built this department. So many people have stayed. There's so much innovation and research that's happened in a place like this. And I was like, this is great. I think this is a wonderful place to start a career. It's very different from, you know, other institutions I've trained at, Bascom Palmer, Duke. But each place you go to will have a different flavor. That is the way it is. And I can bring a little bit of the flavors that I've had before and make that part of my Mass Eye and Ear experience, which I think is important. But that's how I came to my decision, but I think that can change. The pandemic was interesting. I've seen a lot of mid-career physicians hang a shingle now, and they're starting their own practice. Many young physicians are starting their own practices. I moderated a symposium at the ASCRS meeting where it was called Toolkits for Job Success, and folks gave amazing talks on their primer on how to start their own private practice, how much money you need, what steps to take, all the nitty-gritty details, what it's like to transition from private practice to academia or from a different academic institution to another. And it's great to hear people's experiences. I don't think anything is set in stone. There's a staggering percentage of folks who leave their first job and who may actually leave their second job.
Right.
So I feel like it's not, you know, it's not an immediate, like, you know, you can date around a little bit, it seems till you have to marry, which is fine. And for me, that's like scary, but I'm like, that's cool. Well, we'll start with this. I think this is a great fit and we'll go from there.
Yeah. It's funny you made that analogy, because when I used to teach residents, I retired last year from it. I would say, this is your first job. It's kind of like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. It can be great, but it may not be the one you're with forever, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And that's
hard, right?
Yeah.
Because everything you've done is very permanent. Like, you match. This is your residency. Yeah. This is your fellowship. Like, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I get to pick what city I'd like to live in. Like, for me, being in the Northeast was really wonderful. My parents and my family, my extended family is in New York.
Yeah.
So I can take an Amtrak. I can drive. They can come see me. The South was harder. I had to fly everywhere. It was harder to come home for events and stuff like that. So that's a luxury that you get once you finish training. You deserve that opportunity. You deserve to negotiate some of those negotiables like salary and staffing and flexibility in your schedule. Do you want to have admin time?
Like, are you the only full-time ophthalmologist? Are you the only full-time ophthalmologist for your satellite?
No, there's actually three, you know, primary docs that work out of that satellite, and we do the majority of our laser vision correction there and cross-linking. So docs will come and have clinic time there as well.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
It's a pretty busy satellite, but it's cool. We're going to expand. We're moving to a satellite in Lexington, and it'll be multi-specialty. So we'll have retina, glaucoma, all of our laser vision correction. So it's expanding, which will be different. Now that's changing as well. But it'll be give us more access for, you know, resources for our patients.
Right. Yeah. Practice keeps evolving, right?
Yeah, totally.
Practices keep evolving, and, you know, you never know what's kind of next. And yeah, I think it's also important to have chapters in your life. Like, I really enjoy teaching residents for 22 years, from the year 2000 to 2022. But I was very happy to go to the next chapter in life and let's say pass the baton more so than drop the mic.
I like it.
But important. Pass the baton to the young generation. And I wanted to retire too at the peak. Didn't want to be, you know, on the downswing. I don't want to be that guy who's, I don't want to have cataracts on my own while I'm trying to operate on some cataracts, right? Or teach residents about cataract surgery. So
that is funny. No, but it's amazing. I mean, think about how many trainees you've impacted and how many trainees they themselves have impacted. It's like, it's this ripple effect when you're in education.
Yeah.
Like, you're just going to see generations of folks who do things similar to you. Like, we, the Duke Fellows, we have, like, we get together sometimes. They actually have a Duke Fellows course that they started. And so I taught at it this year. And it's so nice to kind of come together and discuss how we all do things very similarly because we were trained similarly. And how we kind of pass that on to, you know, residents and trainees or fellows that we work with, like little tips and tricks that we've picked up. Like, my preference card is exactly what my attendings' preference cards were like. And so one of my colleagues, he actually trained at Duke, and he's just like, give me Nandini's preference card.
Because it's going to be the same.
Because it's going to be
but
the
then,
same.
But then how do you break out of that? How do you develop your own flavor, your own style of doing things? How do you learn new techniques and technologies? Like, you finished your fellowship a few years ago. Well, there are newer products now, newer techniques. How do you keep up with the cutting edge of what's new?
Yeah, I think it's really important to, you know, attend webinars, attend meetings, and talk to your colleagues. I learn so much by just listening. I will read a lot about the new technologies. A lot of these email threads go about which cases they've used a particular lens technology and what has worked, what hasn't. And then I'll start to kind of create my frame of reference and identify patients that I think would be appropriate candidates and tell them, like, hey, this is a new technology. This is what I think are the pros. These are the cons. Is this something you'd be willing to try? I think this could work, but I have a plan B. If it doesn't work, you know, we definitely can, you know, pivot and change things around. You know, for me, I've made a little goal of learning a new technique each year. So my after my first year of practice, I learned SMILE, and that was out of necessity. We're the one location in the region that has the VisuMax laser. So patients come to us saying they want SMILE. And I was initially turning patients away because I didn't know the technique. So I reached out to Zeiss. I practiced my flap creation on the VisuMax. I worked on pig eyes. I went to a webinar. I watched my colleagues do SMILE. And then I jumped in and I identified, you know, easy, high myope candidates, felt confident in my technique. And I've just kind of, you know, rose from there, and it's become a big part of my refractive practice. And my next technique I want to learn is the Evo ICL. So I've been picking the brains of all of my colleagues, listening to talks, speaking to the rep, watching cases folks have done, and then I'm going to start my own cases. So that's the way that I learn. I'm a very visual learner, and I also really need to talk to people about what they do, what their tips and tricks are. Like, if you have a video, I'll watch it and I'll take notes and I'll watch three different people's videos and see what will work for me based on my, you know, operating style. That's what I think is really helpful. And everyone's going to learn differently, right? Sure. Other people are more didactic. Other people just kind of go in and do it. But you want to go prepared and you want to ensure that you're doing right by the patient.
What's the transition like from going from your training, residency and fellowship, where you have an attending, you have a backup, you have someone to rescue you, to now you're in practice and the buck stops with you? You're the bottom line.
Yeah.
What's that like, and how do you navigate that?
It's initially very nerve-wracking. You're always used to having someone to talk to in the OR, and I found that I became very attached to my scrub tech. Like, I have one or two scrub techs that I trust. They're my go-to people, and they know the way that I operate. And I'll be like, what do you think? How does this look? Should I do it this way? Like, what are your thoughts? And then, you know, we kind of bounce ideas off of each other. But I think a lot of it is go slow. Pick. Sure. I didn't quite do this. My first case out of in attending life was a temporary K-Pro PKP vitrectomy combo. Maybe not the first case. And my first phaco was a femto panoptic. So I don't recommend this. This is always me being slightly overachieving. But it's always nice to maybe start with, like, you know, a few simple phacos. Nothing complicated. Take your time. Do the same things you did when you were learning to do phaco. Like, take time to adjust the bed. Make sure the patient's in the right position. Make sure they have adequate anesthesia. Sure. Have all your instruments. Write out your steps if you need to. You know, just, I even had reps come and join me to make sure the femto looked okay and the lens looked okay and the aura was working because it was just a new operating room. I would go watch a few cases before I even did my own just to see how the OR ran. What are simple things like, how do I put orders in? You know, all these academic things I have to do.
Yeah, of course.
But all those things give you peace of mind. And then as you start to do more cases, you develop that confidence. And I think one of the most challenging things when you become an attending is really realizing that, like you said, the buck stops with you. This is your patient. Anything that you do is on you. So you know, you have to take a lot of pride in your work, and you have to be really humble and realize that, you know, things can happen. Own your complications and have really strong communication with your patients. Give them your number, your email, keep them close, really walk them through that process if something happens, because it probably will in your first 100 cases alone.
Well, right? You said something really important, which is own your complications.
Yeah, yeah. It happens. Like, there were simple things I learned. Like, it was funny. I broke a bag just doing cortical removal once because it was a different type of IA that wasn't a silicone tip. It was metal tip at one of my surgical centers. And I just wasn't used to it. And it was a smaller pupil. And I was like, huh, Never had that happen, but you know what? That's okay. I know how to do an anterior vitrectomy. I'll put a three-piece optic capture. And from then on, I learned. I use bimanual for certain types of cases. For all of my femto cases, I'll do bimanual.
Why is that?
I will, just because I find I have better access. The cortex is always stickier. Like for me, it's much more reproducible in my hands if I don't have, say, my Alcon transformer or my silicone tip. I'll kind of change my technique. So you'll find ways that you figure out where you went wrong once or twice, and then you can change your technique in an appropriate method, and you'll do much better, and you're feeling more confident as you do it.
Do you ever have issues where patients will say, because most of our cataract patients obviously are geriatric, and they'll say, "Doctor, you look so young. How do you how do you deal with that?"
Oh my gosh! You know what's really funny? We stopped wearing masks on Friday.
Okay.
And I, like, people haven't seen my face. So today was the first day I really wasn't wearing masks in clinic. Every other patient said that.
Oh, wow. That's so funny. We had the post today, huh?
And I was like, that's so funny. I mean, I'm like, ha, ha, ha.
So what do you say?
I mean, I'm just like, honestly, I'll say, well, I'm old enough to be your doctor. Don't you worry.
I guess that works well.
That's usually what I say. Or sometimes I'll be like, guess how old I am? And I'll just kind of distract them. But usually, like, it's just, you know, pleasantries. I'll just kind of say something and move on with the conversation. But it's tough. It's tough being a young female physician, because I think many times patients do question your age. They question your training and expertise. I think I get asked a lot, like, how long have you done this? You know, how confident are you in the procedure? And I'm very forthright. I say I've been in practice for 3 years. I've trained for multiple years. I feel very confident. I've put hundreds of these lenses. I've, you know, done hundreds of these surgeries. You know, these are my thoughts. But if you ever want a second opinion, I'm always happy to help facilitate that.
Well, that's a very smart approach.
And, you know, I think, you know, one will say yes to that second opinion, but the majority actually, I think, are very satisfied with the response and tend to have a lot of confidence in their surgeon. And I'm happy with that. I'm not trying to take on the most tough patient personality sometimes. And I think when you're a beginning surgeon, that was some advice that was given to me. Like, sometimes if someone's just a really challenging personality, or you think this case just might be above what you feel totally comfortable doing, it's okay to say, you know, I think there's someone who can do this a little bit better than me. Let me see if I can help make that transition for you to be under their care. And I think the patients are very appreciative of that too.
Sure.
Because they just, at the end of the day, want to be taken care of.
Sure.
And they may not think of it in the granular detail that we do, right? I'm like, oh, like, this technique is so complicated. They're just like, can you fix this? Like,
yeah.
Can you just do it? So
no, I totally understand the feeling there. And, you know, sometimes there's patient differences in personality. I've had a patient recently where I just said, you know, I'm just not the surgeon for you. I just mm-hmm. I don't want to do your surgery. And they're like, what? But I said, I don't think I can make you happy. I know mm-hmm. what the potential outcome is of the procedure. I know the limitation of the technology. And I just don't know if you'll be satisfied. So for that reason, I just don't wish to proceed with your elective IOL surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's okay. Yeah, it's okay to do that.
You know, it's okay to say no to surgery too. You know, when you start out, you're so hungry for cases. You're mm-hmm. like, you want to operate, right? And I think you'll do one or two cases that maybe humble you, and you realize that perhaps you should not have operated. And that starts to teach you that, okay, if you think that a patient is not a good candidate, or we're not going to be able to meet their vision expectations, it's okay to say, you know, I think you might be fine. Like, say a LASIK patient. Like, I've had some patients that are so nervous. They'll come into the office, like, just the concept of having surgery just terrifies them. And I'm like, you know, it's totally okay to just wear your daily disposable contacts.
Yeah.
You're doing fine. Like, stick with it. And hey, if you think in a year or two you can do this, let me know. We can do it. You're a good candidate.
That's such a great way of doing it.
But I really think you have, and even like today, I had, you know, one or two patients where I said no to surgery. You know, they've had multiple retinal detachments, multiple, you know, like, they were aphakic. They want, you know, a DSEC. And I'm just like, I don't know if you really need the surgery. Like, yeah. I genuinely think less is more sometimes, but I'm actually having her see my colleague for a second opinion, because I'm like, I'd love for you to get all the opinions and figure out what's going to work best for you. But sometimes for me, I think that perhaps we don't need to necessarily do something surgical. Medical management at this time is more comfortable. and for you sure. have another a good eye. So that's a big tip, I think, for young surgeons. It is really important. Learn to feel comfortable saying no if you think that's the appropriate choice.
Yeah, like there's a saying, right? You can get any surgeon to say yes to every case, but it takes someone with judgment to say, maybe not this case. And then also, you know, we soon realized that oftentimes the fewest number of surgeries is the best. Not doing more and more and more and more procedures. I mean, those ocular tissues can only take so much.
Exactly. I know. The eye gets tired.
For sure. What are some of the research projects that you're involved in? You said you had obviously a long history of doing research, and now you're kind of running your own show. What are the projects you like now, or what are your specific areas of interest?
Yeah, I don't think I spend as much time on research anymore. I think I did a ton as a trainee, and I'm trying to figure out how I balance clinical practice with pretty much everything else, because clinical practice is really busy. But I think one nice way that was recommended to me was to do an industry-sponsored trial. So I'm working with one of the companies to kind of look at their lenses in a certain demographic of patients and see how that lens fares. So it's a nice way to work with industry, get grant funding, recruit patients, and kind of prospectively, you know, see their outcomes. And I like looking at, you know, new premium lens technology and seeing how it fares in patients. Our center is also involved in a clinical trial for endothelial keratoplasty. So that's really nice. I like to recruit patients for that. And I also attend a lot of their organization meetings. So I learn a lot about how a clinical trial is designed and conducted. And it's a ton of work, but it's very insightful for me to be a part of that process. And then small things, you know, like with residents, I'll do small projects like articles or case reports and, you know, help them get opportunities to get their name out there and build their CV. So that's been the nice way that I'm getting involved in research. And I hope that I can start to kind of bring in, you know, more trial funding if I'm able to, as my practice grows and as I identify, you know, a patient area that I think would be interesting to study.
Wow, that's neat. Yeah, things do shift. Oftentimes when you're in training, you do a lot more research, even on the basic science side.
Yeah.
And then as you get into practice, it tends to be far, far more clinical.
Totally. I think clinical research is fun. And I think it's the way that you apply what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, but you can contribute to, you know, a new way to think about how something is used or how patients do. But I also think you need to be mindful of the types of patients you see and what you think is feasible to study, right? You don't want to pick a research question and see zero patients with that condition in your practice.
You don't want to do something so rare that you never see them, right?
Exactly. So that is something that I'm very actively looking at, seeing like what patterns am I seeing in my clinic, and what are ideas for possible retrospective case, you know, retrospective reviews. That's something nice that you can get involved, trainees can get involved in. You can kind of produce something, have opportunities to present that while also doing prospective type studies as well. But basic science, I don't think I'm quite doing that anymore.
Yes, yeah, it's funny how we end up changing gears, though, you know?
Yeah, I can't really pick up a mouse and check its cornea anymore. I tried that in medical school, and I was like, no, thank you. I'll stick to animals. I'll stick to humans.
Humans, right. No, I'm with you. Same way here. How do you split your week in terms of OR, clinic, admin time? What's the split for you?
Yeah, I typically get a day or a half a day a week of admin time. So that's actually nice. Mm. You can catch up on stuff, but also do something outside of medicine, which is important. And then I usually do OR one day a week. I'll do refractive, you know, a few times a month. And then I'll have clinic pretty much the remainder of the time. So it's a pretty good schedule. Some weeks we'll have more clinic time, less OR time, depending on which week of the month it is. That's how it's broken down. But it's a nice mix. I like to have a little bit of clinic and a little bit of procedural each week. I think that helps balance it out for me. And I've come to embrace the admin time. It's funny how quickly your admin time can get eaten up, though, if you start to add on that case or have a whole day of meetings or, you know, add in little things that you need to do to catch up. So for me, one of my goals is actually to protect that time and really use it to focus on things that I need to do, as well as prioritize, you know, my own mental health and my physical health and my financial health. I like to spend time thinking about what I'm doing with my money.
how do you do a work-life balance? Sometimes that's very challenging. In the past, I was so bad at that. I had no balance at all. I was such a workaholic. I'm much better now, but how does a young person navigate that?
It's tough. You know, I always joke that during training, like, my life was ophthalmology.
Right.
You know, it was really hard. Like, I remember people were like, what are your hobbies? Like, what do you do for fun? And I'm like, I mean, if I had free time, I probably would find something to do, but I spend half my time studying. Like, I don't really understand. But now we have so much free time. That has been the most interesting transition from training into practice, is that a lot of my time is my own. I have weekends off. I have admin time. So for me, it's been little things. Like, I got a Peloton. I love working out on it. I started picking up golf, and I take lessons, and that's been like my new challenge. I'm very bad at it, but I love it. I'm addicted because I keep wanting to get better at a little thing. And I restrung my violin after 5 years, and so I'm starting to play. I used to play in my medical school orchestra. I was like really gung-ho, and I took lessons at the Eastman School of Music, and I just kind of dropped it in training because I didn't have time. And now I get to do that, and I try to see my family and hang out with friends, and sometimes I just veg out and watch Netflix for long periods of time, and that's okay. That's good for my mental health.
Yeah, it's all a balance, for sure.
But it's hard. I think everyone does that differently, and I don't think anyone does that perfectly. And depending on what your family structure is, and if you have children, or if you have loved ones you're taking care of, that time gets split very differently. But it's certainly something that I've come to really appreciate, that you really need to prioritize yourself, because we may not have done that for a long period of our time without realizing it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then I think another one that I find is fun is traveling. And it's almost all ophthalmology related. Like this weekend, I'm going to Brazil for the Brazilian cataract refractive meeting.
Oh, Brascaris?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called? Oh,
exactly.
Cool. That's awesome.
It's going to be an amazing time. And I've been to Brazil a few times before. What an amazing place. But early this year, I did the APAO, the Asia Pacific Academy in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, which is an amazing meeting. But how do you then, whether you have an academic employer, how do you negotiate in there enough time to go to? Let's say you want to go to Academy every year in ASCRS and Hawaii&I and OS in New York and maybe a couple international meetings. ESCRS is going to be in Vienna this September. How do you kind of negotiate? It's easy for me. I work for me. So I can do anything I want. But how do you negotiate all this? Because those weeks can add up.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that it was a formal negotiation process. I think definitely my institution encourages us to, you know, be at national meetings and to present and to have that visibility, because I'm able to educate on a national level and kind of impact so many more people than just, say, my patients or the people at my institution. But I'm very mindful of it. It's never really been a formal conversation. Like, we have a set budget as to how much is allocated per year towards CME-related travel. And the rest is on me. I mean, I will pick the meetings that I want to go to, but I'll also say make up ORs or make up clinic times when I have the opportunity to do so, to make sure that my clinical practice isn't suffering. And then I'll also carve out time to have personal vacations or do something fun. I'm going to Bali for 2 weeks with my family.
Wow.
This for my birthday, which is our first international vacation in like almost 4 years. So I think it's been very natural and very easy to do, but I'm also very cognizant that I need to be producing. I need to earn my salary. And yes, it was guaranteed for 3 years, which is nice, but you still want to build your practice and you want to be able to see those patients and continue to operate and do fun cases that you can present at these meetings. So that's part of the drive too. You want to keep yourself active and engaged both at the, you know, work front as well as in the personal front.
Right. So like you were saying, presenting your cases. So obviously you have to operate, but you also are then therefore recording your cases.
Yes. I listen to your advice. I still record every case. I mean, I did. I recorded every case as a resident, every case as a fellow, and I still record to this date. Like, my OR is like, you're still going to record this FACO? I'm like, absolutely. What if something happens?
Right.
I want it. I watch my game time footage because something always weird happens, and I'd like to see what stupid thing I may have done or why it behaved this way. And that's always great. I'm always bummed when the video doesn't work for some reason. And I'm like, well, that would have been an interesting teaching point. And even I tell patients, I'm like, you're famous. I showed your video at a conference. Like, we learned something. I taught people something and they gave me feedback. Or if it's a challenging procedure or a challenging clinical scenario, like, my patients love it when I'm like, I had a panel of cornea experts and this is what they thought of how I did it.
That's cool.
And this is what they think the next step is. But I really encourage people to record their cases. I learned so much by watching myself, and I learned so much by watching others. Like, there's days I'm pulling up your videos before like a pseudo ex FACO. I'm like, let me just see what Uday did. Make sure I know. Okay, make my Rexus, get it out of the bag, chop it, Faco it.
Boom.
Done.
Exactly. Yeah, I record on a USB drive, but I just keep recording over them. If it's just routine cases, I don't save years and years of cases. I have one USB drive, and when it gets full, I just erase and re-record. But no, I think you have to. That, and it's funny too, when you speak at these meetings, you have to be an expert at, like, it's a different skill set. Mm-hmm. Public speaking, a little more enunciating, mm-hmm. a little bit slower, editing video, researching stuff to make sure, wait, am I saying this right? Let me make sure I'm not saying this. So people don't realize sometimes a 5-minute video takes a lot more effort than 5 minutes. It's a lot of work.
Totally. I still remember when I was a fellow at Duke, I was picking the brains of all the residents. I'm like, how do you use iMovie? And I would have them, like, sit with me. And I was like, okay, how do I cut? How do I do this? And I would, like, spend so much time editing. And now it's so second nature to me. But it's a skill you need to have, because you need to be able to edit your cases and be able to present at these meetings. And I so agree. Like, we both just presented at ASCRS, and I was on multiple symposia. And the amount of work it takes to prep for these is a lot. And I'm sure you get better at this with time, but really making sure the quality of your work is excellent, because so many people are seeing it, making sure that everything is factually correct, practicing it. I practice all of my talks. I want to make sure that I sound polished and eloquent. And then being able to field questions, and also being able to give your thoughts and inputs on what others are speaking about and share your opinions. I think it's a totally different skill set, and it takes a lot of practice. And that's been something I genuinely enjoy. And I think that's also a reason that I like to be on the podium. I love public speaking, and I really love teaching. And that to me has always come a bit naturally, but it's a skill I love working on. So not everyone likes it. Like, I have friends who are like, why are you voluntarily giving talks? And I'm like, this is fun for me, but it may not be fun for someone else, and that's totally okay.
Right. But plus, by teaching the topic, boy, you learn a lot.
Totally. And you learn so much.
Yeah.
There's always, like, little minutiae, little details. You want to read the studies, the literature. You want to know those nitty-gritty details. You never know when you need to be able to pull out those statistics. So you become an expert.
Yeah.
Slowly, in your little mini area that you're learning.
Yeah, slowly, slowly but surely.
Yeah.
So what's next on the horizon for you? You're always going to keep cranking the way you're doing now, public speaking, doing your surgeries. What's coming next for you? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. I mean, my 5-year plan is to survive so far, which I think has begun. Oh,
you're doing amazing. You're thriving. Forget surviving. You're thriving. That's amazing.
Oh, gosh. No, it's funny. I think I planned a lot of my life up to this point. I was very methodical. And at this point, it has become, it's kind of like your flow state. I think I'm really working to refine my craft, you know, be as engaged as possible, do what I enjoy, and see what comes next. I really don't have any, you know, formulated plan, other than I vocalize if I'm interested in something, and I say, hey, can I get involved in this if it's something that interests me? But other than that, I've just really enjoyed the process. And I think that's so important. I was reading this book this weekend, and they talked about this pyramid of purpose.
Okay.
Where there's a few different stages. It's, I think, learn, experiment, thrive, struggle, and then win. So you're spending the majority of the time learning and experimenting, figuring out what you need to know, how you're doing it. And then you kind of thrive. You're doing it. And you're going to have struggles. You have to embrace them. But you shouldn't be trying to strive for the top of the pyramid, which is a fraction of the time of winning. Because that's such a small part of that entire journey.
Right.
You really need to love the journey. And I think that's been my mindset now. I'm like, let me just enjoy this process and see what those wins are. And when I get those wins, great. I'm going to love them and then start it all over again.
So success is basically, it's the whole journey. It's the whole process. It's not just, okay, I just crossed the finish line first and I won.
Yeah.
That's the one end point, but there's a whole process leading to that.
Totally. It's like, you matched into residency. Cool. Like, you're on a high the day of the match. And then you're like, I got to go through residency.
Because that's how the work begins. Now, speaking of which, we talk sometimes about the surgical learning curve. So now you've done more than 1,000 FACOs. In residency, most people do, let's say, a couple hundred. On some programs, 100, some 200, maybe some programs, 300 FACOs. Maybe you do another 100 or so in fellowship. What's the progression like from, let's say, case 200 to case 500 to case 1,000? What have you found? Because you're very close to that. So it's only a few years ago for you.
You know, I think there's a very steep learning curve in your first probably 200 cases. Like, yeah. Immense, right? Like, I still remember I was over accommodating so much in a scope that my attending would switch me out like every 5 minutes because she's like, you can't see, but I was seeing everything and I was so dejected. And then until someone pointed out to me, like, stop over accommodating. Yeah. This is how you make sure you focus. Things clicked into place. And I think that initial learning curve is just getting comfortable in the eye. You're getting a sense of anatomy, instruments, positioning, how to do the steps. Then I think from like 200 to 500, you are starting to experiment more. You're doing the tougher cases. You're trying different techniques. You are trying a variety of different types of surgeries. If you say you're doing cornea or retina or glaucoma. And then I think as you're hitting that 1,000 level, it's really finding a method that works for you and doing it the same way every time and making and refining each step of the way. Just like your cases, like every single step I see, I can predict now because you do things very, very identically in each step. And that's how many of my attendings showed me how to operate. And you find the way that works for you and you make that the way that you approach your cases. And you're very reproducible and you're very predictable. And that's how you know that if something goes astray, you can point out exactly why it happened sometimes. And that's how I felt. I think I've grown so much in my last 3 years of practice. I feel so different when I'm the surgeon in the operating room. Yeah. And it's a mental thing. Like it's like I just walk in and I'm like, all right, let's have a great day. Like I know my patients, I know my cases, I know my hands. I'm going to do this, but I'm always open to asking for help, or if something goes differently than I expect, I'll call someone into the OR. That's the beauty of being in academics, right? I had a DSEC and it wasn't attaching in some weird way. And I called in one of my colleagues and I'm like, any thoughts? Like what else can I do? And you know, like sometimes what I did worked and other times they'll give me a tip or trick and that will save the day. But I really, there's so much to be said about, you know, practice and like that 10,000 hour rule or 1,000 cases. You really feel that, and it's kind of a personal journey. It's hard to articulate how that feels, but I certainly, you know, I encourage people to really practice and do things in a very consistent manner because you will see results.
I'll tell you something even more amazing, which you're going to find out very shortly. From case 1,000 to case 5,000 is another step.
Oh, great.
And you're like, wow. It's like, and then you hit case 10,000. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm still picking up little, the things that happen rarely. Well, now you've seen them a few times.
Right.
For, you know, for better or for worse. But I think there's just so much to learn. I still learn every day in the OR.
That's so cool. I mean, surgery is the best, is one of the best parts of what we do.
It's my happy place
It's my happy place. Like I do this to operate and I love seeing patients and I love talking to them, but I just love operating. And I'm so happy that I can say that because that's not always the journey. And I know I've watched some of your episodes where you're just like, residents reach out to me and they're like, should I keep operating? Like,
That was one of the most popular videos we had this last year. I'll just give some background if you didn't see that video, where a resident wrote in and said, you know, I'm really struggling in the operating room. It's really just eating at me. And I'm questioning myself. And the question was, should I give up operating? So that's a complicated topic. What's your advice for that anonymous struggling doctor?
Yeah. I mean, I really hope that you can find a mentor or someone that you can confide in and have them really handhold you through some of those tough times. You know, it helped me when I was struggling like that to have one or two docs who would just sit with me, watch me the entire case, let me struggle, and really help me identify what I was doing well and what I wasn't. And I think sometimes things have to be broken down so fundamentally because everyone learns differently. Sure. And to be able to have that support system is so important. And I also think you need to have a support system that you can speak to confidentially. So if it's your friends, talk to them about the tough cases, go through your complications, get insights from senior residents as to what you can do differently. I just think talking about it and working through one step at a time can be very helpful. And I mean, be honest with yourself. You know, sometimes some things may not be the best in your hands, and perhaps those techniques you don't want to do, but there might be other techniques that you do very well, and those might be the ones that you want to focus on.
Sure. So don't give up, right?
I hope not. I mean, try your best. I really think that, you know, you have 3 years to learn. use that time wisely and seek resources. Like for me, I went to a bunch of wet labs that were industry sponsored, like the Alcon course, the J&J course that they offer for residents. There's also AAO and ASCRS wet labs. I mean, these are great opportunities, non-judgment zone, to go practice on model eyes, try new techniques, really get different perspectives. Like say you're just not getting the kind of feedback you want at your institution. Mm-hmm. Sometimes talking to docs from different places coming to teach a bunch of residents gave me such interesting tips and tricks. I was like, cool, yeah, let me go try that. Or, oh, I understand, you know, phaco dynamics so much differently than I was taught before. Like I remember I went to an AAO wet lab to do the Yamani technique. You know who my teacher was? Boris Malyugin.
Oh, how fun is that?
I was like, oh, hello, can we take a selfie? Also, I've never done this before. Like, let me dock a needle and struggle. And he was so patient. He just sat there and was like, so kindly helping me and so excited when I finished it. Yes. I'm like, that must have made you sweat. That was an hour of your life.
You got to learn these. Absolutely. You got to learn these techniques.
You do. And it takes practice and it takes time. And you have to give yourself grace. You're never going to be great at something the first 10 times.
Oh, that's a neat way of putting it. Sure. Yeah, like when I was with the residents, I was teaching. I first taught myself how to do DMEC, and then I could do it with the residents. And yeah, I'd watch people operate. I watched like Peter Veldman in Chicago operate. Oh my God, he makes it look so easy. And then Martin Dürresheimer from Austria, he operates the D. It looks like it's like nothing. And then you go there, like, oh my gosh, it's much harder than it looks.
Totally, the eye humbles you. Yeah, nothing ever acts the same. And that, I mean, you learn from it. You're like, I'm never doing it that way again.
You're right. The first 10 cases, I think you're right. You need about 10 cases of any new thing. And that's assuming you already have a set of surgical skills. Like you're already an established surgeon. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just, I have to remind myself that nothing is going to be great the first time I do it. Like, or you have beginner's luck. And then afterwards, you're going to be like, well, that didn't go as smoothly for a few times. And then you'll just continue to improve. And I think you have to be patient with yourself. Well, that's one of the toughest parts as a surgeon. We're all type A. We want to be perfect all the time.
Right. And we're always, like I always teach you, even be your own toughest critic.
Right. We are. And we should be. Yeah. But sometimes we have to back off.
How do you tell a patient that I've never done a Yamane, but I want to do one for you? How do you discuss with a patient?
Yeah. I mean, I'll say that this is a new technique. You know, many of us have practiced this. And it's something that I think would work well for you. If you're open to us trying it on you, we'll definitely do it. But we also have a plan B and C in case it doesn't quite work out.
Then you can pivot.
And so I can pivot. Or sometimes I'll also say, like, if I have a colleague who can join me in the OR, I'll say, hey, like, I have, you know, experienced doctor with us too. And he or she can help me out if we need it. And they can be a second set of eyes and hands to help out if necessary. I think patients love that.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah, I like it's very heartfelt, the way you say the message.
Yeah, I mean, I recall, like, you know, I had a tough smile case, like one of, you know, my first maybe 50 cases where it was a thin lenticule. And, you know, I was just having a tough time dissecting it. And I called in my colleague and she was so gracious. She helped out. And while I was waiting for her to come in, I told the patient, I was like, you know, this is a really tough case. I'm going to have someone who's done many of these come help me out. I want you to know that you're in the best of hands. You have two surgeons watching this and we're going to make sure you're getting taken care of. And that patient was 20/20 the next day and was happy. Yeah. So thankful and did not for one moment, I don't think, judged me for the fact that we had to, you know, just have a second set of hands, maybe help out for one key step of the process.
Yeah, I agree with the patient. If it was me, I'd want the same thing. And that's the mark of a good surgeon.
And then from then on, I learned, you know, I saw what I did differently that time and I've never quite made that, you know, so I've pivoted that technique.
What was the key difference?
It was just how slow I identify my anterior and posterior planes, especially in a thin lenticule.
Sure.
And I'm just so much more mindful and I look for so many more key landmarks in terms of my feel. I never rush those steps. I go extra slow and then the rest of the dissection is so much faster. But when you're first learning a technique, like you don't have a set rhythm or pace and it's a learning curve. It's true. Like you read papers about smile and everyone says there's that steep learning curve. Like the first several cases for a surgeon are tough and then it gets much better. But I think if you're genuine to a patient and if you're...
They sense it.
If what you do, if you believe in what you do, I think they sense it. It's like trying to tell them to do a technique, but you're like wishy-washy about it.
Yeah.
Or you're like, oh, like, you know, there's a trifocal, but, you know, it has some issues, but I'm not really sure. But there's also the monofocal. An indecisive doctor is going to be a detriment to an indecisive patient.
Yeah, I see that.
You want to be confident and you want to believe in what you're providing to them. And, you know, I think I pick up on that with my own healthcare providers. Like, I know when they're surefire, like, believing in what they're saying versus maybe they're saying what I want to hear.
You can sense that. You get a sense of it.
You can sense that, but that's okay. Like, I think we're all perceptive, even if it's just body language or how we're talking or, you know, simple phrases that we're saying.
How do you choose LASIK versus SMILE? Let's say you have your typical 20, 30-year-old refractive patient, moderate myope, minus 3, 4, 5 myope. How do you choose one over the other?
Yeah, I mean, I use the same criteria. I have to make sure, like, everything on their topography, tomography, prescription is comparable. And then, you know, I'll tell them about both techniques. I'll say, you know, LASIK has a flap. It's a long, well-tried-and-true procedure. This is how we do the procedure. SMILE is interesting because we don't create the flap. We don't have to remove the skin cells. Everything is done in the cornea. These are the restrictions you may have for a week after LASIK. You don't really have any restrictions after SMILE. You know, this is how I touch you up. I can sometimes do LASIK with LASIK again. I can't really do SMILE again, so we may have to do PRK. I kind of just lay it out to them.
Sure.
And then I say, I'll just say, you know, for most of my moderate myopes, I do SMILE. I like the technique. And so I'll say, you know, I recommend SMILE. I think this will be a great option for you. If there's any reason you think LASIK would be better, just let me know. And I think there's a subset of patients that come in asking for LASIK and I give it to them. And there is a subset that say, oh, SMILE sounds really interesting. Let me do that. So it's never, I don't know. My approach is very matter of fact. I'm really not a salesperson.
No, of course.
This is what I think. And I think you will benefit from this procedure, but I'm open to hear what you want. So if there's anything that I'm saying that's deterring you from one option or the other, please tell me because I want to do what will help you sleep better at night.
Yeah,
and I think they resonate with that, and most of them they'll self-select. Like my OR days are like a little bit of SMILE, a little bit of LASIK, a little bit of PRK.
That's fun. A little bit of everything.
You can't be a one-trick pony.
That's true. You want more tools in the toolbox, not fewer. I got you there.
Yeah.
So what technologies, just to end this, wrap up, what technologies coming down the road are you excited about?
Yeah, we just got the light adjustable lens at Mass Eye and Ear, so I'm really interested to see which patients I'm going to start recruiting for that and start using it in. The IC8 Apthera lens is intriguing me as well. You know, off-label use in irregular corneas interests me because I do see a lot of irregular corneas in my practice. But also using it in a virgin eye as an EDOF lens is very compelling. I think those two are exciting for me. The EVO ICL is huge.
What about 5 years, 10 years from now?
Yeah, I'm really interested in injectable cell therapy. And I think that's coming in several years. We're starting a lot of clinical trials. I think it's going to be interesting what role endothelial keratoplasty will play and how things will change in 5 years. We all are so obsessed with doing DMEC.
Right.
And soon we might not even do DMEC. We might just be having the patients come in, injecting cells, have them position, and then seeing them back in a few weeks. So that, I think, is very exciting in the next 5, 10 years to see how that technology kind of grows.
Wow. Yeah, on the cornea side. What about on the cataract side? Do you think anything's coming in 5 or 10 years? What do you hope for? What's on your dream list?
My dream list is a true accommodating IOL.
Sure.
Like that's really going to be the holy grail in terms of showing patients something that's very similar to their crystalline lens. So that I'm excited about. And there's so many interesting technologies that are being developed in terms of, you know, replaceable implants in the capsular bag where you can exchange lenses. Like you can put a lens in, take it out, put an alternative lens. I think that will show a lot of promise, especially with how many new lens technologies we're getting now. So I think there's a lot that's on the horizon and I think it's just starting. What I do now is going to be totally different from what I do in 10 years. I use all different lenses than what I used in training.
Right.
Already.
That's a very important lesson.
Years.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Like what my technologies I'm using now are already different. I can't wait to see what I'm doing in 10 years because will be like, oh yeah, back in the day we used this. And now, you know, new hot thing on the market.
Yeah, in all seriousness, the evolution in ophthalmology is pretty rapid, and things evolve on a sometimes there's evolution, but sometimes even there's revolution in ophthalmology. Things happen a lot faster. But just to think, like, I mean, the things that came in the last 10 years that didn't exist 10 years ago, you'll have even more in the future. And you can't operate today the same way you did 10 years ago. And similarly, in the future, you can't operate the same way you're operating now. You got to keep evolving.
True. Absolutely.
Onwards and upwards, like your career path. I thank you for being on our podcast. I'm so excited about seeing you on the podium and how you just keep progressing. You're doing amazing things, and you're certainly going to change our field for the better. So I'm really honored to have you on our podcast. And I want to tell everyone to check out the links below. And any wrap-up words for you?
No, thank you, Uday. It's so humbling and heartwarming to hear people say that. And really a big thank you to everyone who's helped me up to this point. I hope that I can continue to help the next generation and lift them like those have lifted me. So thank you. And it's always so wonderful to hang out with you and learn from you. And I can't wait to continue to listen to all the other episodes on this podcast.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nandini, for participating in an amazing podcast. And thank you guys for being so supportive of our new venture here, the Cataract Coach Podcast. We're going to keep up with a new episode every single week. It's always going to be a very interesting discussion with an important surgeon or leader in ophthalmology. And our goal is to learn together. See you next week.